Well, the title of this morning's message is The Heart of God at the Heart of the Psalm, Psalm 27, which we already read in part this morning. But I'd like to begin our message this morning with a kvetch, a complaint. And here's my complaint. Why do I have to lock every door of my house and my car? Why must I give a sizable chunk of my income every month to a company just in case my car is stolen, or just in case my house burns down, or just in case somebody trips on the sidewalk outside my house and decides to sue me? Why does my credit card have to have 16 numbers on the front, 3 more on the back? Why do I have to have a PIN number? Why do I have to sign my name on the back of checks? And why do I get asked for my ID when I go to buy something with my credit card? Why is it that at any given time, either the roof or the washing machine is leaking? And why is it at that same time that the drain seems not to work? And why is it that every faucet ever made in the history of mankind eventually starts dripping even after you shut the water off? Why does the toast fall off my plate and land on the table with the dry side down, but if it hits the floor, it's always with the jam side down? And right after the dogs have walked by and shed. Why does the phone ring without fail right when I'm headed out the door? And why do I only get a penny for my thoughts, but I have to put my 2 cents in? I'm losing on every transaction. These, of course, are silly little laments. But this world is full of destruction and violence. And we see it in the news every week. We're reading about natural disasters, man-made disasters, man waging war against man, violence. And it brings pain and sorrow, despair over the loss of life. Well, how do we make sense of it? And how can we make a difference? How many times have you heard the expression or even used it yourself, in a perfect world, right, and you fill in the blank. In a perfect world, it's one of the ways we acknowledge the inevitability of troubles and trials, injustice and sorrow in the world. It's a broken world. And that figure of speech in a perfect world reveals, if unconsciously, that we can envision a better world. So then it's legitimate to hope for a world to come, a much better world. But for now, it is painfully apparent that this present world is broken, it's fractured, weighed down by sin. And how do we cope in a broken and sin-filled world? Well, let me rephrase that. I think we can do better than cope. How can we thrive in the midst of a broken world and sin-filled world? Is it possible to have joy, to thrive in the midst of all this? If so, how? How is it that some people seem to have genuine peace and an outlook of optimism despite all the insanity? What is their secret? The Tehillim, the Psalms, especially those written by King David, seem to express so well our lament in the face of life's difficulties and sorrows, and the occasional dismay of betrayal by those close to us, and the vicious attacks of those who hate us for no good reason. But these same psalms offer us answers, and they do point the way for us to achieve true shalom in an unpredictable and sometimes painful world. This morning, I invite you to turn to Psalm 27, David's affirmation of trust amidst troubles. And from Psalm 27, let's take encouragement from the Lord. First, let me share a few details about this psalm. Psalm 27 is part of what is the first of 5 major sections of the Psalms. Many of the psalms in this first section, this first of five, are laments. Psalm 27 has some of that element, so you're going to see the lament in there, but it also is a song that expresses confidence in Adonai. Now, some scholars, seeing in the first six verses this theme of trust, but in the last eight verses a personal lament, have argued that this probably was originally two entirely separate writings, which were later brought together by editors. I don't believe that, nor do I think you should. A little later this morning, I'll explain why I don't think that's the case, and I hope to show why this is a single, very thoughtful, very intentional, and a very structured song. So here we go. Psalm 27:1, a psalm of David. Adonai ori v'yishai, the Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the defense of my life. Whom shall I dread? Now, how many of you have read the book, the famous book by George Orwell, whose real name is Eric Blair, 1984? Let me see. How many of you read 1984? Okay. Now, how many of you have not yet read 1984? Notice I say yet. Okay, I really think you should. It wasn't written in 1984. It was written a long time ago, but he saw what was coming. All right, 1984 by George Orwell. In this book, which is actually a denunciation of totalitarianism, it was also a warning against what we call today political correctness. The lack of freedom to speak our minds without being criminalized for it. In this novel, Orwell describes a scary place, which is ironically called the Ministry of Love. Because in Orwell's 1984, words don't mean what they're supposed to mean. Now, this place, the Ministry of Love, is where political dissidents, or even those suspected of nonconformity to the government, would be taken. A re-education center, if you will. And in the inner recesses of the Ministry of Love, there was a particularly dreadful place. You guys remember what it's called? Room 101, that's right. Room 101, and you would just shudder at the name. Room 101 held a different terror for each person who was brought in there. Because the party, meaning the government, spied on all its subjects, they knew what each person's greatest fear was. But it highlights the fact that each human being has particular things that they fear. Fear is a powerful emotion, and it comes to us in a variety of ways. There are some kinds of fear that are good and appropriate and can keep us from physical or spiritual harm. I mean, you should be afraid of some things, like becoming addicted to drugs or contracting a deadly sexually transmitted disease. Look, you'd be dysfunctional if you weren't afraid of such things. And there are other things that you might be afraid of that are also logical. I can appreciate that some people's hobbies require them to overcome fear, but there's no way I'm going to ever take up skydiving. Not happening. Ever. The only time I'm going to be in the sky is if I'm flying somewhere or I'm flying to heaven with you all. And then we'll be changed. We won't be afraid, right? It's normal to fear some things. There is also a healthy kind of fear in our relationship to the God of the universe. Not a terrifying kind of fear, you know, that would send us running in a panic. Remember the Cowardly Lion in The Wizard of Oz? He goes running out of that place. That scene stigmatized me as a little kid. I could identify with that cowardly lion, but that's not the kind of fear that we're talking about when we talk about the fear of the Lord. Instead, it's a deep, abiding reverence for who he is and the knowledge that he created the universe and that one day we will appear before him and give an account for our lives. And if you are in a right relationship with God, if you have proper reverence for him, you will never need to fear other people. Right? I've seen it in bumper sticker slogans. He who bows before God can stand before any man. The Lord is my light and my salvation, David writes. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the defense of my life. Whom shall I dread? If he were writing this today, he'd say, bring it. I'm glad he isn't writing today. But he's still speaking to us today. Men may seek our lives, but they cannot touch our souls. And the only one who actually does have the power to destroy your soul has no intention of doing so. He loves you. Let me qualify that. When I say that the Lord loves you, I'm not affirming universalism. There are some who are listening that are not yet believers in Jesus the Messiah. And we are not universalists here. We do not believe that everyone will eventually be saved. I refer exclusively to those who are committed followers of Yeshua, Jesus the Messiah. If you have not yet transferred your loyalty to Yeshua and publicly declared your faith in him, this promise doesn't apply to you. God is the light and the salvation of those only who are in a contractual relationship with him. And Doug can relate to that. He's an attorney. Larry could relate to that, right? They're attorneys. Right? These promises are within covenant. These promises only apply to those who have contracted that business with the Lord and gotten right with him and transferred their loyalty to Yeshua. It's otherwise known as the new covenant. And I say these things for the benefit of anyone either here or who's listening online who has not yet made that commitment, whether you're young or old. Every single human being must surrender to Yeshua, Jesus. Having parents who believe doesn't cut it. Having children or other relatives who believe doesn't cut it. You don't get to piggyback on somebody else's faith. It's got to be your own. If you haven't formally committed to following him, then I urge you to speak with me or with Dave Goldstein or any of our counsel. And if you go to a church somewhere else, I invite you to speak with the pastor of your church if you have not yet made that commitment. Because if you haven't, you have unfinished business with the Lord. David, who was called the sweet psalmist of Israel, wrote out of his own personal experience. As a Na'ar, a young lad, David shepherded the flocks of his father Jesse. And we read about it as he tells his story later to King Saul that he had to fight off predatory animals. Little David had faced the bear and the lion, and through the help of God, had emerged victorious. While still young, still a Na'ar, he faced off against the Philistine champion Goliath, 9 foot 6 inches tall. And then to win the hand of King Saul's daughter, he put 1,000 Philistines to death. As a man, David became a seasoned warrior, but he was not without enemies, kings of foreign lands. Even his father-in-law Saul was an enemy to him. Many believe that this psalm, Psalm 27, was written while David was hiding out from Saul and having to also to contend with various foreign powers. But God did not allow David to fall into the hands of any of his enemies. And so he continues, verses 2 and 3. When evildoers came upon me to devour my flesh, my adversaries and my enemies, they stumbled and fell. Though a host encamp against me, my heart will not fear. Though war arise against me, in spite of this, I shall be confident. In a fallen world, it should not surprise us that evildoers abound and that they seek to harm the people of God. Now, you personally may never be surrounded by an enemy army, but even if you are, the one who fights on your behalf is greater than all the assembled armies of all the nations of the world. David's good friend Jonathan understood this perfectly when he said to his personal armor bearer, "Nothing can hinder the Lord from saving, whether by many or by few." And a few minutes later, the two of them took on and defeated an entire garrison of Philistine soldiers. The prophet Elijah understood this perfectly when he took on the 850 false prophets of Baal and Asherah, and God answered him with fire from heaven. Elisha understood this perfectly when the army of Syria surrounded him. He prayed that God would open his servant's eyes, and suddenly Gehazi, his servant, saw an enormous angelic army poised on the mountainside, far mightier and far more numerous than the army of Syria. Now, this passage in Psalm 27 should not be taken as an ironclad promise that no harm will ever befall you. That's not the purpose of the Psalms. Sometimes we misuse them when we try to make them ironclad promise. Oh, I'm promised this, 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 and nothing bad will ever happen to me. Really? And unfortunately, a lot of people have bought into that. They believe promises that God never actually made, and then when those promises don't materialize, they hold God to blame. It's not an ironclad promise. Good and godly men and women have been persecuted, tortured, and martyred across the ages. Rather, this is a meditation on the confidence that we can have knowing that God has good and eternal purposes for us. And frequently he does deliver us. Remind me sometime to tell you about the time I fell asleep on the way from Montana to Idaho and woke up in a whole different place behind the wheel of my car, still safe. But don't put the Lord to the test. Okay. Verse 4. One thing I have asked from the Lord, that I shall seek. One thing, right? We have a song based on it. Achad sha'alti me'et Adonai. One thing I seek or I ask of the Lord, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life. To behold the beauty of the Lord and to meditate in his temple. Now remember, King David wrote this. The temple didn't exist in his day. He just knew that there would be that place, that sacred place. David isn't pleading with God to rescue him. He isn't asking for riches or honor. He's not asking for a shiny new Harley Davidson. What is his one request? He's not even asking for victory over his enemies. Right? What is his one request? That he might spend as much time as possible in the presence of the Lord. The thing David is asking is so simple and yet so profound, and we miss it. Remember, too, that David was not from the tribe of Levi. David was from the tribe of Yehuda. And because he's not from the tribe of Levi, in a sense, he's praying for and planning to build a house that he himself would have only limited access to. This reminds me of Anna, the prophetess, who was in the temple at the time that Joseph and Miriam brought Yeshua to consecrate him. Luke tells us that Anna had been a widow for many years, and all that time devoted herself to fasting, to praying, to serving. She was privileged to see God's Messiah firsthand and to tell everyone about him. How important is it to you to gather with the people of God and to worship him and to meditate on his goodness? Verses 5 through 7. For in the day of trouble, he will conceal me in his tabernacle. In the secret place of his tent, he will hide me. He will lift me up on a rock. And now my head will be lifted up above my enemies around me, and I will offer in his tent sacrifices with shouts of joy. I will sing. Yes, I will sing praises to the Lord. Hear, O Lord, when I cry with my voice, and be gracious to me and answer me. God did conceal David. Saul couldn't capture him in spite of marshaling all his resources. David and his men enjoyed protection and provision at the tabernacle from Ahimelech, the priest. He was protected in the wilderness of En Gedi, beautiful hidden oasis in the midst of the Judean desert. He was vindicated when Saul realized that David had had the opportunity to kill him and yet spared his life. Despite the many months of wandering and being on the run for his life, David was confident that he would again have the opportunity to come and worship God at the tabernacle. He asks God to hear his plea, a simple desire to be free to worship him once again. Now, there is a Hebrew word that describes being delivered from danger and being brought to a place of safety. And that Hebrew word is yasha, from which we get Yeshua. Adonai saves. That's Jesus' Hebrew name. If you had been delivered from calamity, wouldn't you also want to shout for joy in his house and worship him and sing songs to him? Of course you would. But some people are foolish. Some people think they can just wait till the end of their rope or the end of their life, and then maybe they'll get serious. We have a saying. Maybe you haven't heard it. A lot of people who decide to wait till the 11th hour to get serious with the Lord die at 10:30. If you're serious about God, the time is now. The day is today. Verse 8. When you said, "Seek my face," my heart said to you, "Your face, O Lord, I shall seek." If someone were to ask, "What is the secret to a good life?" this would be my answer. The secret to thriving in an otherwise unstable, unpredictable, sometimes hostile world isn't by seeking stability or comfort or riches or security. Seek him. Seek his face. Seek God himself. Psalm 34:4 says, "I sought the Lord, and he answered me and delivered me from all my fears." Verse 8 is not only part of the two middle verses of Psalm 27. It is at the center of it. It is the heart of the whole message. Now, today we kind of take things for granted. You've got a Bible in front of you, right? You have access to it, or maybe you have a phone and you're reading the Bible on your phone, but in any case, you have it right in front of you. In the ancient world, people did not have that luxury. They heard the scriptures being read aloud in the Kehillah, and they became very practiced hearers. And they knew instinctively when they were at the center, the crux, the nugget of the message. They knew because they were very learned listeners. And here in Psalm 27, as though purposely tucked away right in the middle, waiting to be found for those who are diligent and listening and observant, we find this verse. When you said, "Seek my face," my heart said to you, "Your face, O Lord, I shall seek." This is that precious nugget that we're supposed to take away from this. God is saying to you, "Seek my face, seek my presence." So let your heart respond obediently. "Your face, your presence, O Lord, I shall seek." But how do you do it? How do you seek the presence of Adonai? Well, the fact is we know what to do, right? It's not rocket science. We just need to do it. But for many of us, I think we fail because we don't take to heart when we should do it. We let the day get away from us. For most of us, the key is to quiet our hearts, put aside distractions, open his word, read, pray, and listen at the beginning of the day. At the beginning of the day. Because I think probably every one of us knows what it's like when we don't spend those minutes, that precious quiet time with him in the morning, and the day just takes us away. And we become a servant of the day. We become servants to the demands of the hour. We need to seek him early in the morning when it's quiet. We would be wise also to seek him late at night when it's quiet, when the phone hopefully isn't ringing. Just as we bring him the first of our earnings, doesn't it make sense that we consecrate to him the first of our time? Think about that. We talk about a tithe. We talk about the first part of our income we give to him. And we're glad to do it, but time is even more valuable. You know, I've known people who have made and lost fortunes and made them again. You can always get money back. You can't get back your time. It's your most precious commodity. The extent to which you value him, give him the first of your time in the day. And I'm preaching to myself too. And if we'll do that, if we'll seek God himself, seek his presence, that's like the master key. That unlocks every single lock, opens every single door. It's the foundation for enjoying shalom in a world that so lacks shalom. Seek his face, verses 9 and 10, because he won't hide from you. Do not hide your face from me. Do not turn away your servant in anger. You have been my help. Do not abandon nor forsake me, O God of my salvation. For my father and my mother have forsaken me, but the Lord will take me up. This is both a lament and a declaration of trust. Most of us enjoy good relationships with our mothers and fathers, but some people really identify with verse 10. Some know exactly what it means to be forsaken, even by a parent. But here is one father who will never leave you and never forsake you. David knows that even those closest to us will at times disappoint us or even abandon us. Remember, Messiah wasn't betrayed by a complete stranger. Who was it that betrayed him but one of the people closest to him in this world? And in the hour of his death, Yeshua still affirmed his trust, saying with very nearly his last breath, "Father, into your hand I commit my spirit." Those are powerful and capable hands. Can you say with David, "Ezrat Chayiti, you have been my help"? Verse 11. "Teach me your way, O Lord, and lead me in a level path because of my foes." Just as David asked to know God more intimately, now he also asks to be more familiar with God's ways and that God would help him to lead a good and godly life. He knew that his enemies were looking for any excuse to disparage him. His prayer, in essence, was, "Lord, guide me and teach me your ways so that they won't have any excuse to malign me." If people at work and people in your neighborhood know that you are a follower of Yeshua, and I hope people at work and in your neighborhood really know that you're the local Jesus freak. If people at work and in your neighborhood know that you're a believer, you can count on one thing. They are watching you. Now, some are watching hopefully, wondering if there really is a better way to live, wondering if there really is a better world that awaits us. They're hoping for your success, and they might just follow suit. But there are others watching you, hoping that you'll screw up royally, so that they'll have an excuse to not believe. Harris, what a hypocrite. Yeah, whatever he believes, I don't want any part of it. We can't afford to have that happen. So for both their sakes and our own, this needs to be our prayer. Teach me your ways, O Lord, and lead me in a level path, a straight path, yashar, straight or upright. Verses 12 and 13. "Do not deliver me over to the desire of my adversaries, for false witnesses have risen against me, and such as breathe out violence. I would have despaired unless I had believed that I would see the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living." These verses parallel verses 2 and 3. David declares that enemies have arisen and brazenly lied through their teeth to bring him down. They also threatened physical harm. The world is filled with such people. And as true as it was for David, If we don't have the Lord as our strength and our help and shelter, we might very well be in despair too. In this one psalm, David expresses both dismay at the viciousness of his enemies and yet complete trust, confidence in the God of Israel to be his deliverer yet again. Here, David declares confidence that he will not die at the hands of his enemies. But again, I believe we can see in the life and the words of David a foreshadowing of Messiah himself. In passages such as Isaiah 53 and Psalm 16, we read about the anointed one, the Messiah of God, dying, yet he would not remain in death's grip, but would rise from the dead and see the light of life. The goodness of the Lord will prevail in the land of the living. Finally, verse 14, wait for the Lord. Be strong and let your heart take courage. Yes, wait for the Lord. When will deliverance come? When will you be vindicated? When will those who seek your demise get their payback? In Yeshua's time. And since we don't know the particulars of all that he has planned for us and purposed, we need to trust in him and wait. But it will happen in his time. Redouble your determination to seek his face and find courage in his presence. Whatever else is going on, some things are just out of our hands. You have a choice. Seek his face. But learn to trust. Don't take matters into your own hands. Wait for the Lord. His people will be vindicated. His plans will be accomplished. Know it and prove you know it by waiting patiently, even if possible, joyously. I mentioned earlier that I take issue with those who suggest that Psalm 27 was not a unity, but was patched together. Let me show you why I believe David is genuinely the author of this psalm and just how thoughtfully he composed it. There is clear structure in this psalm. It takes the form of chiasm. Chi, or ki, is the Greek letter that looks like our X. And by the way, we get the word ki from the Greek letter ki, because it opens things. Things move in parallels towards a center and back out again. So if you, can you read it from where you are? I can't read that one, but anyway. Verse 1 and verse 14, the Lord is my light and salvation, the defense of my life. And then 14, wait for the Lord, be strong, take courage, right? They parallel. Then we move inward, verses 2 and 3, deliverance from enemies, deliverance from evildoers, and confidence in spite of it. Verses 12 and 13 toward the bottom, deliverance from enemies, false witnesses. And he says, I believe I will live and see the Lord. Verse 4, my request to dwell in his house, to meditate on his beauty. Verse 11, my request, teach me your way, lead me in a level path. Do you see what's happening as it comes in and goes back out? They're parallels. Verses 5 through 7, the Lord will lift me up. Verses 9 and 10, the Lord will take me up. And what is dead center? It's Psalm 27, the nugget. You said, seek my face, I will seek your face. The heart of the Father at the heart of the psalm. The admonition to seek God's face. He's inviting you to do so. And you will be supremely blessed if you comply. Seek his face. First thing, let's go ahead and clear that. I can always make you a copy if you want to see that again. Seek his face. Do it first thing in the morning. Let it be your priority to seek out the presence of the Lord at first light. The dividends are out of this world. As David, the sweet psalmist of Israel, wrote elsewhere, you will make known to me the path of life. In your presence is fullness of joy. At your right hand, there are pleasures forevermore.